If you love this podcast and IPR, you probably know that it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Rick Brewer, a talk show producer at Iowa Public Radio. And part of my job is connecting with Iowans who have stories to tell. When you contribute to IPR, you help make that possible. Membership contributions make up 57% of IPR's budget. That's huge and amazing. So do your part to support the podcast and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap the red donate button. Thank you.
It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So much coming your way this hour. Our quick conversations on our Friday News Buzz to end the week. Tom Vilsack, once again confirmed as U.S. Ag Secretary. We'll talk about the challenges before him with ISU economist Chad Hart in just a moment. Also, James Lynch will be along in this first half hour to talk about the controversial legislation that has dashed through the State House this week. We remember Paul Johnson, a fierce advocate for the land, and you'll want to hear toward the end of the hour, University of Iowa astrophysicist Jasper Halicus on why the latest Mars rover is unlike any NASA mission in history. But first, let's start off the hour with an update on the pandemic and our vaccination campaign. Joining us, Michaela Ram, healthcare reporter with the Gazette. Hi, Michaela.
Hi, Ben.
Well, let's talk about advances in, well, knowing when we get vaccinated. Those of us Iowans who have not been vaccinated yet, we got some more information from the governor. She held a press conference yesterday. What did she have for messages?
So she released some big information yesterday. Namely, she released a projected vaccination timeline for a lot of these populations that are qualifying right now for a vaccine. So right now, the effort is really focusing on Iowans 65 and older, first responders, and school and childcare staff. But right now, we have a projected idea of when we can move on to essential workers and individuals with disabilities who are living at home with caregivers. According to the projection she released yesterday, we should start seeing those vaccinations to start in March.
In March. Okay. So does this... is this ahead of the timeline that we had previous to this week? Is this a more optimistic view based on the data the governor is getting?
That's a good question. My understanding is that this was along the same lines of what we expected. The allocation has been slow and hasn't been... it's been steady, I should say that, but it hasn't been moving as quickly as people expected. And because of that, and just because of the high number of people who qualify at this point, I think this was along the lines that people were expecting.
Well, also in her press conference yesterday, our governor announced a new website available to assist Iowans to obtain the COVID-19 vaccine. And I know, Michaela, you've done a lot of reporting, talking to people very frustrated with, how do I do this? How do I know? Where do I sign up? Well, let's listen to the governor, and you can tell us a little bit more about this new website, vaccinate.iowa.gov. Here's Governor Reynolds from yesterday.
Tomorrow, we'll be launching a new website with the latest information you need to know. Vaccinate.iowa.gov will provide information about eligibility resources available to assist Iowans and answers to frequently asked questions. It will also include a vaccine locator so you can find providers near you, click through to their websites to check availability and to get details about scheduling. But I want to be clear, you cannot schedule an appointment on this site or register to be contacted when scheduling is available, but it will connect you to a provider for scheduling in their system.
Okay, that was the governor yesterday. By tomorrow, she means today. Today is when that's available, vaccinate.iowa.gov. Michaela, tell us more about what you will be able to and won't be able to do on this website.
From the looks of it, this website is more like a locator map. So you can take a look at this website and see where is the nearest place that a vaccine may be available to me, which providers are offering vaccines in my neighborhood, in my city, in my county, etc. So it sounds like it really helps kind of put the effort to find an appointment in one location for you. You know, at this point, before this point, you know, you had three or four different websites you could check. You had to go to your My Chart for your local healthcare provider. So it seems like this website is really trying to put it into one place for Iowans.
Okay, vaccinate.iowa.gov is the website. Michaela, there is a call center alternative for those who don't have a computer or those who just don't feel like they want to use a website, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So starting March 8th, it sounds like the state 211 hotline will be made available to Iowans seeking help getting vaccine appointment. Or specifically, it should be for Iowans 65 and older having difficulty navigating the process. And we know at this point there are a lot of people who have trouble with that. You know, there's a lot of Iowans who of that age group who, you know, maybe they have internet access, but they aren't necessarily tech savvy enough to kind of track down and figure out how they need to get that appointment. So this resource was really made available to them to help those Iowans who are struggling at this point.
Michaela, you've done interviews with some frustrated seniors. Tell us about the experience of a person, an Iowan or two you spoke with to demonstrate this frustration.
So one person I spoke to in particular, her name is Eileen Barron. She is a Kelowna resident. She and her husband a couple weeks ago were trying to get a vaccine appointment. So they live in Washington County, and how Washington County made appointments available to residents was essentially setting up a call center. And starting at 9 a.m., you can call in and try to nail down an appointment. And for 5 hours, she was on the phone trying to get an appointment. And she described it as this, you know, she never got through to anyone. It was just busy signal the whole time. And so she just said she was continuously hitting redial, you know, hang up, busy signal, hang up, or hang up, dial, busy signal, you know, just continuous for 5 hours. And so she was frustrated, to say the least, when she ultimately didn't get a vaccine appointment for her and her husband at Washington County. Now, not necessarily to the fault to the county. You know, they are very limited. The demand is very high. But, you know, it's instances like that Iowans are dealing with at this point.
Right. And I know this week, Michaela, you wrote about a Cedar Rapids free medical clinic also to address older Iowans struggling to get vaccinated. What do you find out about that?
So the Community Health Free Clinic is the free medical clinic in Cedar Rapids. And the CEO, Darlene Schmidt, was really hearing all of these older Iowans expressing their frustration and just feeling overwhelmed when it comes to trying to track down a vaccine appointment online. So she said, you know, anyone 65 and older, if you can get to Cedar Rapids and can get an appointment, you can call this number and we will put you on our wait list. And once your turn comes up for an appointment, we will call you and you can come get a vaccine appointment. So she's made that phone number available to them. And, you know, hopefully eventually it'll help kind of chip away at some of these Iowans struggling to get an appointment.
Indeed, that is a big challenge at the moment in this vaccination campaign. Michaela Ram is healthcare reporter with the Gazette. Michaela, thanks for your reporting and for this conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's get an update now on an active week at the Iowa State House. James Q. Lynch is with us, reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, covers politics and the legislature, as we all know. James, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Ben.
Well, front and center, we have to have you give us an update on Republican efforts to quickly, and I do mean quickly, pass a sweeping law in changes in Iowa's election laws on its way to the governor's desk after gaining final approval this week by Republican lawmakers. What are the major changes?
There are several, Ben, and I think the one that gets the most attention is this law, which the governor is likely to sign. She hasn't said whether or not, but it's likely she will sign it. It reduces the number of days of early voting from 29 to 20, and people might remember that a few years ago it was 40 days of early voting, and Republicans shrank that down to 29 days, and now they're going to 20. And like I said, this has gotten a lot of attention, but to put it in perspective, the average early voting period in the states across the nation is 22 days. So 20 days is in the ballpark, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. Iowa was something of an outlier with that 40-day early voting window, and even 29 days was above average. Of course, there's nothing wrong with being above average, I guess. This also reduces the number of days that auditors can send out those absentee ballots before the election. They can only have one drop box for absentee ballots, one drop box per county. auditors can't send out ballots, absentee ballot request forms to all registered voters, like auditors in Johnson and Lynn and a few other counties did. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of changes here. It also creates a Class D felony if auditors don't follow the state election laws.
Wow. Okay. Iowa's turnout rate in the last election, 76%, among the highest in the country. The election was absolutely secure here in Iowa. No one's arguing about that. No cases of election fraud reported. So what's the reason for all these new election laws? If the machine is working well, why do the Republicans say we need this?
You know, that's the question that Democrats kept asking throughout the debate in both the Senate and the House is, what's the problem? What are we trying to fix here? And it's interesting that in the Senate, there was some talk about a stolen election, that this the presidential election was stolen from Donald Trump. Of course, voters in Iowa preferred Donald Trump to Joe Biden. But it's not like Iowa Republicans are losing elections and they need to change the rules. They're winning here, but they still want to change the rules. Over in the House Speaker Pat Grassley made a point of saying, you know, this is not about stolen elections. This is just about secure elections. And so, I mean, we had this kind of, I don't know, yin and yang between the Senate and the House as far as why they were doing this. But you're right. It doesn't seem like there is a problem to be fixed. Turnout was high. You know, nobody reported any fraud or other problems with the election. The only problems really were just handling the turnout. I mean, you know, it created a lot of work for county auditors, but they handled it.
Yeah, and a political scientist this week on this show also pointed out when you further restrict elections in this way, there are studies that show that it disproportionately affects groups of voters who are less likely to vote Republican. Was that talked about at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, that was part of the argument against this bill that Democrats made, that it disproportionately affects people of color, people who live in marginal communities, in poverty, in some cases, older voters. One of the things here is there wasn't much of a debate about this law. Mm-hmm. Republicans had the votes. They put it up there. Democrats talked about how bad it is and what the consequences will be, and yet it still passed. I think it's a hard argument to make for Democrats in a way, because every time there's an election bill, they say, you know, this is voter suppression. And then the next election rolls around and turnout is 76%. So, okay, it doesn't seem like voter suppression.
Yeah.
That's high. That's among the highest turnout rates in the nation. So, 76% is really good. But yeah, the studies show that it affects some communities more than others, some voters more than others. They're less likely to vote. And those are the people who, like you said, are less likely to vote.
Yeah. James, with a couple minutes that we have remaining, let's dash through some other big items at the Iowa legislature this week. Governor Kim Reynolds signed an education funding package. Tell us about that. In reading about it, I saw no school choice, no voucher in that. What did that come out as?
Well, the bill that she signed puts another $36.5 million into the state's support for local school districts. That's a 2.4% increase. It sounds like a lot of money, $36.5 million, but if you divide it evenly among the 327 school districts, that's about $112,000 each. This is on top of nearly $3.4 billion the state is spending this year, which is on top of what the local districts put in to support their schools. This didn't include school choice or vouchers. Those are moving in other bills, and they're not necessarily moving at the same speed in the House and the Senate. The House seems to be proceeding a little more slowly on this, which I find interesting. We'll still see those bills, and we'll have those debates before the session is over, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Democrats wanting a larger increase. You wrote in your article on this, Iowa not keeping up with our neighboring states in terms of per pupil investment in education. Let's have you briefly talk about what you heard this week from Debbie Durham. She's chief of the Iowa Economic Development Authority. What picture did she give us this week of how the economy, battered by this pandemic, has suffered?
Well, Debbie Durham, you know, told a legislative committee that she thought 2020 was going to be the best year of her time, you know, in state government. And then COVID happened and a derecho and things like that. However, she's still very optimistic, very bullish on the Iowa economy. She says that it's poised for recovery, especially like in the manufacturing sector. The hospitality sector, of course, is still suffering. Restaurants, bars, hotels, tourism. But she said, because of the decisions the legislature and the governor made to keep the economy open, to keep people working, Iowa's economy is strong. The biggest problem that she talked about was there are too few Iowans. There are more jobs than there are people to fill them. Mm-hmm. And said, you know, Iowa has to grow its population, which, you know, if you look at some of the legislation moving through the House and the Senate, doesn't seem to be a great advertisement for coming to Iowa.
James Lynch, reporter with the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Thanks.
You bet. Thanks, Ben.
It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, there have been a few bumps in the road for President Biden in getting his cabinet confirmed, but Tom Vilsack was not one of them. This week, the U.S. Senate confirmed the former Iowa governor as U.S. Ag Secretary. The 92-7 vote places Vilsack back in the office he occupied from 2009 to 2017 under then-President Obama. Our two U.S. senators, Grassley and Ernst, were both in the yay column in support. Vilsack is already the second longest-serving U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. Let's talk about the challenges the new Ag Secretary faces with Chad Hart, professor of economics, also crop markets specialist and extension economist at Iowa State University. Chad, welcome back to the program.
My pleasure to be with you today.
Let's talk about the crisis facing the nation first. How will the COVID crisis affect Vilsack's agenda?
Well, definitely, that's one of the first things on his plate. If you think about the CARES Act and the various COVID relief packages we've had, they've always had a piece for agriculture within those. There's a piece within the new legislation moving through Congress right now, but one of the things that sort of got stopped as we transitioned from the Trump administration to the Biden administration were some of those COVID payments going to farmers. One of the first things Secretary Vilsack will be doing is looking to re-energize those payments to get those out in as quick an order as possible.
Mm-hmm. And the challenges when we conceive, you know, we were caught surprised, caught by surprise by this COVID crisis, also longer term planning and dealing with the threat of pandemics in the future?
Definitely, that'll be part of the mix here. You know, looking at how agriculture fared through the COVID crisis, looking at how our agricultural market structure worked well through this pandemic, where were the pinch points or breakdowns that we did have out there, and how do you work around them or through them as you look here? And so I think especially as we think about, you know, the connection from the farm to the table, the idea is that we did see some of those pinch points definitely create problems for agriculture as we dealt with the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Food insecurity, that was revealed in this pandemic. We've had it before, even worse in terms of food and nutrition for some communities in our country. That's on his plate, right?
That is on his plate, and that was something that was on his plate. If you think back to his previous time as secretary, he did spend more time than I would call it the typical agricultural secretary thinking about that nutrition security and assistance to our consumers out there, especially that are struggling financially.
Mm-hmm. Social justice is something Tom Vilsack put as an aim, of course, a big theme in 2020. How will that figure into his job as Ag Secretary?
Well, it figures in because if you think back again to his previous session as secretary, that was a time where we did see the U.S. Department of Agriculture provide some reparations to minority farmers due to bias that had built into some of the programs over time under USDA. I think you'll see that sort of, let's call it introspection, continue under Secretary Vilsack in his new term.
Mm-hmm. Climate change, the other big challenge facing the world and our nation. How does that figure into Vilsack's aims?
Factors in very greatly just because that's been a marker that his boss, President Biden, put on his plate. As we look at the climate change, not only do we see Secretary Vilsack being asked to do something there, but we have a new cabinet appointment with it's special counsel Kerry on climate change. But specifically for Secretary Vilsack, he's got about 60 days to come up with a report sort of outlining potential strategies that USDA can take as far as sculpting programs to address climate change through an agricultural lens.
Mm-hmm. Any idea on how that would be a departure from the previous 4 years, specifically affecting Iowa's ag sector?
Well, right now, it's not laid out. We do not know. I mean, one of the things that is being discussed is the idea of creating what they call a carbon bank or a carbon market so that we could use, if you will, the funding that the Trump administration had used to provide support from, say, either trade policy or even, these COVID payments, and redirect that into the climate change area for agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Tom Vilsack will be able to hit the ground running. His chair at the it did warm off. His chair is no longer warm, I guess, is what I want to say there in Washington. But there is no need for him to learn the ropes. This gives him an advantage, doesn't it?
An advantage and a disadvantage, I would say. The idea is that, he was one of the few appointments in President Biden's cabinet where he was a known commodity. He had been in this role before. Therefore, the proponents and the opponents both knew sort of prior history. That gives him an advantage, but that also gives him the disadvantage of there's no honeymoon here. Everybody has worked with him in the past.
Okay. He succeeds Sonny Perdue, a Republican from Georgia, serving under President Trump. Does that make a difference whether we have a Southerner or a Midwesterner in this position?
Oftentimes it is seen that it does just because of, let's call it, the knowledge base of the secretary going in. I think, though, when you look at the vote that Secretary Vilsack received, basically all parts of the country were fairly comfortable proceeding forward with him.
Okay. Thank you very much. Chad Hart, professor of economics, crop markets specialist, extension economist at Iowa State University, giving us the read on what is Tom Vilsack, already the second longest serving U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, and to add on to that tenure. Chad Hart, thank you for your views this half hour.
Thank you, sir.
Coming up in our second half hour after a break, we remember Paul Johnson, a fierce advocate for the land. Also toward the end of the hour, University of Iowa astrophysicist Jasper Halicus will talk about why the latest Mars rover is unlike any NASA mission in history. And then we'll groove into the weekend with C.C. Mitchell. So, as you can see, plenty ahead on this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break.
Novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a Friday NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up yet this half hour, University of Iowa astrophysicist Jasper Halicus on why the latest Mars rover is unlike any NASA mission in history. Also, of course, at the end of the hour, C.C. Mitchell will be with us to groove us into the weekend. Before that, earlier this month, Iowa lost a fierce advocate for the land, Paul Johnson. He was a farmer, but much more, a state and national leader in the movement to conserve America's soil and water. Johnson died on February 15th on his farm in Decorah, surrounded by his family. He was 79. Joining us to celebrate his life and legacy, Neil Hamilton, Emeritus Professor of Law at Drake University, also a board member of the Iowa Natural Heritage Foundation. He just wrote a remembrance of Johnson titled Remembering Paul Johnson, a Hero in Conservation. Neil Hamilton, welcome to the program. You write you had the pleasure of knowing and working with Paul for 40 years. Our condolences for the loss of your friend.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate this opportunity to be with you, Ben, and to share with your listeners some thoughts about Paul and the incredible legacy that he left our state and nation and our land.
Paul Johnson served as director of Iowa's Department of Natural Resources from 1999 to 2000. Before that, he was a chief of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Resources Conservation Service from 94 to 97. He is also, before that, a Democratic state legislator. You write, he was the most significant voice for nature of our last half century.
Well, his legacy, you've recounted three of the major positions he had, but certainly from the perspective of Iowans, his legacy is most well experienced through his work as a state legislator. And incredible leadership and innovation, and the two perhaps most important pieces of legislation that he helped author and shepherd through the legislature were the Resource Enhancement Program, known as REAP, and then also the 1987 Groundwater Protection Act. You know, REAP is a program that Iowans are, they've experienced it, whether they've realized it or not. It has funded over 17,000 projects from local parks and trails to contributions to state parks to water quality and conservation programs all across our state, over $500 million invested through REAP in the over 30 years that it's been in existence.
So Iowans have a lot to be thankful for when we, and now we're getting to be springtime, we can enjoy the outdoors a little bit more than we could a couple of weeks ago. Wow. But
I think certainly this period of the COVID lockdown, you know, has put such an increased emphasis on people's ability to get outside and to use nature and to experience our trails. And a lot of what people have and have been enjoying is in part due to Paul's legacy.
Right. And Paul Johnson said, you know, one of the influences on him was, among others, the great Aldo Leopold. But he had influences on people in office. Let me read a quote from Tom Vilsack, of course, now, again, U.S. Ag Secretary. He mentored me as governor when, as director of the National Iowa Department of Natural Resources, he led the effort to make Iowa the national leader in the use of buffer strips. And then another quote from Vilsack, I carried his lessons to the USDA when records were set for acres enrolled in conservation programs. So there it rolls on. His influence is felt not only on our land, but through other people currently in office.
Very much so. You know, he was certainly an administrator and a legislator and a leader, but he was also an educator and inspired landowners and farmers and citizens to think differently about the relationship with nature. I mean, that was how he was, I think, most directly a Leopoldian, living Aldo Leopold's land ethic. Recognizing that we're really in a relationship or a community with the land and nature, as opposed to just thinking about it in simply economic terms, as we unfortunately so often do.
Neil, I'm seeing in the Register article, he was a son of a minister, grew up in South Dakota, graduated from high school in suburban Chicago, received his bachelor's and master's degree in forest ecology, the University of Michigan, before going to work at the U.S. Forest Service. Interestingly, served in the Peace Corps in Ghana. I would like to know from you, as someone who knew Paul for four decades, you talked about his achievements. One of the quotes you write about was that really jumps out at me, especially in the times that we live in right now. His decisions were grounded in what was morally right, not just what was politically right or financially right. That's kind of in short supply these days, isn't it? Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I would agree, and I think the loss of someone like Paul makes us recognize how much we miss leaders like that, and the approach that they brought to their work. It was grounded in a sense of morality, and as I said, that was in part Leopold's approach. And I think to put it into the context of legislation, Paul was a Democrat, obviously, and it was a time when the Democrats had some control of the legislature. But those pieces of legislation that he was championing were designed to actually achieve something, right? There was a goal, there was a purpose, it was harnessing the law and civic institutions to do something. And it seems today that oftentimes the legislation is perhaps designed to create the appearance of doing something without really doing anything. And I contrast something like our nutrient reduction strategy, which is essentially a hollow shell. It doesn't require anything of anyone. And it's not clear that, in fact, Iowans will benefit if, in fact, we somehow reduce nutrients in the water as opposed to having a plan for a clean water program for the state. And compare that to the things that Paul and his colleagues were doing with REAP and with the groundwater protection program that closed our ag drainage wells and put us on a course of trying to prevent that type of pollution. It was very much a positive view of how government could assist and empower individuals and communities in achieving things.
Okay, Neil Hamilton, who had the pleasure of knowing and working with Paul Johnson for 40 years, Neil Hamilton of Drake University, celebrating the life of Paul Johnson, farmer, much more, a conservationist with so much impact in his life. He died in mid-February on his farm in Decorah, surrounded by family at the age of 79. Neil Hamilton, so important to have you help us remember this powerful figure in the conservation movement.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And we're coming to the end of this News Buzz edition of River to River. Earlier this week, NASA scientists unveiled a first-of-a-kind home movie of sort of last week's Daredevil Mars rover landing. Perhaps you saw it on broadcast or online. We saw vivid images of this craft's supersonic parachute deployment over the Red Planet and a rocket-powered hovercraft lowering the science lab on wheels to the surface. Its name is Perseverance. Its new home, a vast basin on the fourth planet from the sun called Jezero, the Jezero Crater. If I got that pronunciation right, I'm not sure. Jasper Halicus is with us, associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Jasper, welcome back to our program.
Ben, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
This is interesting. The most advanced astrobiology lab ever sent to another world. First of all, describe your thoughts when watching this historic first landing footage and hearing what's believed to be the first ambient sound directly recorded on the surface of Mars and played back for us humans.
Well, first of all, if you haven't watched this video of the landing, it's well worth 3 minutes of your time. It's really phenomenal. It's not the first time that we've landed something on Mars using similar techniques to this, but it's the first time we've taken high-definition video of it from multiple viewpoints. So being able to look down at the rover as it gets lowered down to the surface and being able to look upward from the rover at the rockets that are firing to keep the thing from slamming into the ground and seeing all of this unfold is really quite an experience. It's really a technological marvel.
Right, and it's interesting. Perhaps you can explain the physics here because it has to do with the Martian atmosphere. We saw this red and white parachute being shot into the sky above the rover with this upward-looking camera. We could see it. The spacecraft, when that was deployed, was hurtling toward the ground at nearly 2 times the speed of sound. That we could not do on Earth, could we?
Yeah, so it turns out that landing on Mars is really hard. It's one of the hardest things to do in our whole solar system. You could think of Mars as being sort of in the opposite of the Goldilocks zone. It's really the anti-Goldilocks zone for landing on a planet, because it's got enough atmosphere that when a body falls through that atmosphere, it heats up. And so that means you need to have some kind of a heat shield. And that heat shield, you know, is heavy. It adds mass and complexity. So there's enough atmosphere to give you problems, but there's not enough atmosphere to slow you down, you know, just using a parachute or something like that that you would use on the Earth or other bodies with a heavy atmosphere. And that's why you come screaming in at supersonic speed and you throw out a parachute to slow yourself down as much as you can, but that's still not good enough. You've still got to have something that'll fire rockets at the last minute and keep you from just, you know, becoming a pile of rubble on the surface. So So Mars is hard.
Yeah, and watching those, the seconds after that deployment of the red and white parachute, as you mentioned, this rocket-powered sky crane vehicle, it fired its thrusters from its four corners, lowered the rover to a safe landing spot on this sort of tethers that were from it, and then we saw the dust billowing from around it. That was remarkable.
Yeah, really something. And the really amazing thing about all of that is that they were doing this terrain relative navigation the whole time. So this thing is smart enough to be taking pictures of the surface and recalibrating the descent based on, you know, what kind of obstacles you're seeing in those pictures. It's almost like a self-driving car, but, you know, landing on Mars.
Right. And explain how this is done when it takes radio waves over 10 minutes to travel from Mars to the Earth.
Yeah, so you can't phone home and ask for instructions. It's all got to be autonomous there in the moment. So the navigation system has a lot of smarts built into it, you know, comparable to a supercomputer here on Earth, because that's exactly right. By the time you phone home and say, hey, should I turn left to avoid this rock? You already hit it.
Right. You hit it several minutes ago.
Exactly.
So did you have the emotional reaction that we saw the NASA engineers had as an astrophysicist here in Iowa to this landing?
Yeah, it's fun for me because I have no direct involvement in this, and I can just sort of be a fan and be impressed by what a technological feat it is.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the mission Perseverance this rover has ahead of it. The primary aim is to look for signs of life that may have died out, what, billions of years ago, right?
Yeah, so there's two main goals that Perseverance has, and both of them I think are very important. One of them, which you mentioned, is to look for signs of ancient life. In my mind, that's, if not the most important scientific question we can ask, you know, right up there, and not just scientific question, but also philosophical and religious question even. Are we alone in the solar system? Is there or has there ever been other life in the solar system? Wow, what a question to try and answer. Perseverance is taking a crack at that. But that's not all that it's doing. It's also the first stage of a multi-mission endeavor called Mars Sample Return. And so Perseverance, along with looking for signs of ancient life, is actually identifying scientifically interesting samples, rocks and soil and so forth, and caching them, which basically means that it's scooping up soil or drill cores and putting it in some tubes and storing those in locations where a subsequent mission can come and pick them up and launch them up into Mars orbit. And then a third mission can pick those up out of Mars orbit, bring them back to Earth, and we can study them in the most advanced laboratories on Earth.
Mm-hmm. And this would, we've never had actual material from another, have we, from another planet brought back to Earth?
Not brought back intentionally. We have had meteorites from other planets land on Earth. And so, you know, if you go down to Antarctica, you can go walk out on the ice and you can find meteorites that have landed on the Earth that ultimately come from other planets. Those have not been treated very well in their journey from wherever they came from to where they land on Earth. And so there's limitations to the things that you can learn from those meteorites. But no, we have never been able to bring a sample back from another planet like this. We brought samples back from the moon, but not from another planet.
Mm-hmm. You briefly touched on the implications further afield than astrophysics, philosophical, even religious implications. If it is confirmed that life once existed on Mars, talk about that a little bit, because this is really the story of space exploration and as in science, right? We confirm things. It kind of adjusts what we our place in the universe, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And in my view, there has to be life somewhere else in the universe because the universe is so huge that I think it would be remarkable if the Earth was the only place that it had ever arisen. But this question of whether there could be life elsewhere in our solar system, that one is, I think, much harder to put a probability on. And whatever the answer it is, it has implications for our understanding of how life develops. If we find that there was or is life on Mars, that maybe tells us that life is really easy to form, that it can form under a diverse array of conditions, and maybe there's life all over the place. On the other hand, if we don't find any life there, then it puts Earth in a little bit more of a special position.
Mm-hmm. How does this mission, this rover, how could it help pave the way for eventual human exploration on the surface of Mars?
Yeah, there are a couple things there. The method that Perseverance used to land doesn't scale up to very heavy payloads. You basically have to have a lot bigger rockets to slow yourself down if you're landing with a heavier payload. So you couldn't use exactly the same landing scheme for humans. However, Perseverance also carries some technology demonstrations that are very relevant for humans, and one of those is an experiment called MOXIE, which is trying to use the resources in situ to produce things that would be useful to humans. Specifically, what it's trying to do is trying to take carbon dioxide, which is all over the place on Mars, it's the majority of the Martian atmosphere, and produce oxygen from that. So it's a chemistry experiment, but if it works, then you could imagine using that oxygen for propellant for the humans to get back off of Mars once they land. And that would really open up things because that means you wouldn't have to carry all your propellant with you. You could make it there on Mars and it'd make it a heck of a lot easier to get back home.
Mm-hmm. And human exploration of Mars as early as what, the 2030s?
Well, Ben, this is where my natural cynicism / pessimism takes over. As long as I can remember, we've been 30 years away from humans on Mars, and I think we're still 30 years away from humans on Mars, unless SpaceX does it. So SpaceX has really done some transformational things out there, and they have some ideas for getting to Mars a lot quicker than that timeline. But someone has to pay them to do it. They're not going to foot the bill on their own. So I think it'll be really interesting to see what develops between NASA and commercial companies like SpaceX that could maybe shorten that 30-year timescale.
Right. I wonder what it is. SpaceX, of course, so impressive in what it's done, the advances that it's made. How can it advance so quickly? NASA's done a great job, but SpaceX seems to be just blaring ahead very quickly.
Yeah, SpaceX is willing to burn resources in a way that NASA has never been willing to do. So SpaceX, what allows them to progress so rapidly is that they make a whole lot of prototypes and they test the heck out of them. They make a prototype and they don't care if it blows up because they learn something from that. And then they make another one and incorporate those lessons. And they have got that cycle down to such a fast cadence that they make really quick progress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are plenty of those mishaps, failures you can find online to watch. And I guess we watch those in a different light, because if that would have happened under the auspices of NASA, it would have been a disaster. But they have built this into just not every day. They, of course, don't want a failure. But as you said, it's part of the learning curve.
Yeah, yeah. And you want to get those failures out of the way when you're doing your development, because, of course, you can't accept a failure once you have humans in that vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So Mars still perhaps decades away. The Matt Damon version of Mars there, right? Though it's still exciting to think about, isn't it, Jasper?
Oh, I think it's very exciting to think about. I mean, if I were younger, I'd be lining up to be one of the first people on Mars. I envy whoever gets to take that first step onto a new planet.
Okay. Are you any good at growing potatoes?
My parents grew potatoes when I was younger. I could probably unearth that knowledge somewhere, but no, I don't have a lot of skills in that respect.
Knowing what I do of you, you are a resourceful man, Jasper, and you would grow potatoes, if necessary, on Mars. Thank you. Jasper Halicus, Associate Professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Iowa. Thanks so much, Jasper.
Thanks, Ben. Always a pleasure.
Likewise. River to River, produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Monday on the program, we'll hear arguments for and against the sweeping changes in the pipeline to Iowa's election laws. We hope you'll tune in and perhaps weigh in with your questions Monday on the program. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a great weekend.